couple of years ago, I had a memorable conversation. I was in a pastoral meeting with someone who was attending our church at the time, and they had had a long-term, almost lifelong practice of meditation and prayer, a profound and deep spirituality. And she commented to me that over all of those years, including the time that she was with our congregation, she said, you know, I've never really had a profound religious or spiritual encounter in worship. It's always been in my prayer and meditation time. And I just heard the words tumble out of my mouth where I said, well, that doesn't surprise me. Worship is really just practice for the rest of our lives. What we do in worship is really just practicing for what happens in all the rest of our life, which is 99% of the rest of the time. And I sort of was taken aback. Does that mean that what I end up doing in worship really doesn't make that much difference? So I've been reflecting on those comments of hers and those comments of mine for a couple of years now. And reflecting on that conversation really became the impetus for this brief sermon series that we're having in August. For 4 weeks, this week and three more, I'm going to preach on some principles that I believe worship teaches us. Things that we learn through the practice of worship. And it's not just those things that we do in worship. There are certainly actions and activities that we do, but I think there are actually deeper principles that we exercise through the practice of worship when we gather for worship, principles that will serve us through our whole lives long. But I begin with an assumption. And that assumption is in the words of our opening song that we are, in fact, made to worship. Not made to be worshiped by others, by the way. I don't mean that, we're made to be worshiped. We are made to worship. The human spirit just naturally seems to respond with a joy or gratitude or awe in the presence of the divine. When it's aware of the presence of God, when we know that we have been touched or felt the wind or the flame of the spirit, when the eternal mystery is here and now, our spirits naturally respond. We're made to worship. And we also seem to naturally want to share that experience with others. It can be a solitary experience, but it usually flows to sharing that experience with others. Because worship is not just a personal response, regardless of the spiritual tradition. It is a corporate response to the holy. So I believe that we are made to worship. And the principles that we practice in worship are good practice for human living. And what we practice here is, in fact, meant to be practiced in our daily life. Unfortunately, I think many of us suffer from what I think is a misguided or perhaps an underdeveloped impression of worship. And by that, what I mean is this. That was probably bad grammar, wasn't it? What I mean is this. Because we gather at a designated time, in our case, this morning, Sunday at 10 a.m., and we gather in a specific place, this building on the corner of 24th and Broadway, and we do some things in our time together that are not typically how we do them elsewhere. We sit, many of us, facing all the same direction. We repeat a prayer or prayers that other people have written for us. We hear readings that we wouldn't necessarily read. Because we don't do what we do here exactly this way in the rest of our lives, and we call this place a sanctuary, I think we erect a boundary that says certain things stay on the inside and other things stay on the outside of that boundary. That is, I believe, one of the reasons that we remind people every Sunday that we want you to be your authentic self, The person you are outside of these walls and doors is the same person that we want to be with us when we gather as MCC Portland. Likewise, the person that you practice when you are here is supposed to be the person you are outside. What happens here for a brief period of time on a Sunday morning is supposed to leak out, is supposed to spill over into the rest of your life and into the world. For example, the person that you step across the aisle to greet at the beginning of worship, will you cross a sidewalk to say hello to in the afternoon? In this room, we all share together the intimate meal of communion on Sunday, but would you dare to be seen sharing a cup of coffee with these people on a Monday? The reading from Benedicta Boland says it so beautifully and so succinctly, even though we heard an extended excerpt. What we do for an hour on Sunday is pointless if we fail to integrate it with the rest of life. It is a matter of integrity, where we get the word integration, integrity, same root. Don't we all yearn to live an integrated life? For those in this room who have ever had any kind of coming out experience, whether it was orientation, identity, or some other deeply held truth about yourself, there is a moment that you know you can no longer live a divided life. You have to be fully who you are everywhere you are. That's integrity. So for a moment, I'm going to practice reversing the words of Sunday morning welcome. Who we are inside these walls and doors is who we want you to be outside of the walls and doors of this place. Who you practice being here is the person that we want you to practice being in the world. Worship is good practice for life. So I have picked four principles. No doubt there could be scores more of them, but it'll be a short series. I start with just four. And the first one is this one. Worship teaches us to prioritize. Worship teaches us to prioritize. And to prioritize is to decide who and what is most important and when. Who and what is most important and when? And that is a life lesson that we all must learn. Whether you have an attention deficit disorder or not, squirrel, something shiny, something, you will still need to learn how to prioritize. Because there will always be multiple conflicting messages tugging at your attention, demanding, oh, me first, oh, me first. I'm the most important. To prioritize is to actually decide and to actually choose. Because if we fail to prioritize, if we fail to choose or decide not to decide, then we will be living driven by somebody else's choices. So, how do we learn that from worship? Think about it for a moment. You're here. What are other things you could be doing on a Sunday morning? Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. For those of us who are not morning people, we would still be sleeping. You could be having brunch with friends. You could be enjoying this beautiful warm weather. There are so many other things that you could be doing with other people in other places right now. But you're here. Praise God. Now, people come to church for all kinds of reasons. They come to meet friends or to meet new people. They come because they've got a job. They come for all kinds of reasons. But let's face it, this is not the only place where you can hear inspiring music and sing along. This is not the only place you can be with others. This is not the only place God is at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning. Either you decided that it was more important to be here than those other places doing those other things, or for some of us at least, we made that decision often enough already in our lives that it's a pattern. It's a priority that we decided long ago, and it's a priority we affirm every time the alarm goes off on a Sunday morning. We're here. Somehow you prioritized that in your life. Now, sometimes prioritizing is a simple matter of choosing between a variety of options. Yesterday, there were six places that I could be at the same time. Well, no, there were not six places I could be at the same time. There were six options, and they were all happening at the same time for me yesterday. Trust me, I am not that popular. That is not a typical Saturday. So the first one is I could have stayed at home, been a couch potato, and done nothing, which is an option I always have to resist on a Saturday. So I usually do it by having my Saturday brunch with the book I'm reading and then my Saturday trip to the gym, followed by picking up our Sunday bagels, which Darren did for us. Thank you, Darren. He took one of those six options off of my plate. But there were three other things. There were three parties that I had been invited to yesterday afternoon. And again, I am not that popular. It was just the day when everyone wanted to have their party. And there were good reasons for me to want to attend all of them. So I chose to go to two. I showed up pretty much a time for one and late to the other one. And I decided to not go to the one at which my presence would be least missed. Now that was a relatively painless, and it was not an earth-shattering prioritization, deciding what of those good options was most important. I missed my trip to the gym. Oh, well. And I ate party food all day long. Well, there you go. But prioritizing quickly becomes a little more complicated when you have to decide, say, well, whose in-laws do you spend which holiday with? Who has the kids for the weekend? And it becomes a little more challenging when you have to decide, which bills get paid this week when there's not enough to cover all of them at home or at church? It becomes heartbreaking during triage when a professional has to choose who gets treated, who gets surgery, and who doesn't. Or when we are confronted with a painful end-of-life choice that many of us have had to make and many more of us will have to make, extending the length, quantity of life versus quality of life for weeks or days. The ability to choose and decide what is most important and when to prioritize is a life lesson we must all learn. Our second reading is one of the most highly treasured passages from the Jewish scriptures. It is named the Shema. Hear, O Israel, Shema Yisrael, the first two words. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God and the Lord is one. It is the central prayer of Judaism. It's often the very first words of scripture that a Jewish child will learn. And even in the very most progressive and liberal synagogues, it is almost certainly to be prominently inscribed somewhere. Shema Yisrael. Many observant Jews recite it twice daily, and during its recitation in synagogue, Orthodox Jews will actually cover their eyes with their right hand. This ancient prayer, this declaration of the central core belief recited and sung for millennia, is a setting priorities prayer, in my view. It begins with a reminder of what and who is most important, and it's repeated throughout the biblical tradition. The Lord is our God, and the Lord is one. And love God with all your heart, with your soul, and strength. That sets a pretty clear priority. And then it moves to this injunction, integrate that priority of loving God into your daily life. Now, sometimes that's interpreted symbolically, but its literal application might be familiar to us. Even if we're not especially familiar with observant Jewish life, we might recognize two things: this instruction to bind it up as a sign upon your hand or arm and between your eyes. It's the practice of binding leather pouches that contain tiny scrolls of Torah. Sometimes they're called phylacteries, but they're more accurately called tefillin. It's from the Hebrew word for prayer. During Jewish daily prayer, mostly men will bind to the top of their foreheads, with straps going behind and down their shoulders, and on the arm, usually their non-dominant arm, will bind with leather straps going down their forearm and a particular fashion around their hand. By the way, this is an interesting aside. Ooh, something shiny. Oh, squirrel. That's for y'all, yeah. I read an article written by an acupuncturist that the traditional locations and the tyings of the tefillin stimulate strategic pressure points and meridians known in Eastern medicine to promote mental clarity and spiritual harmony. So, there's something, isn't that fascinating? So back to the tefillin. Okay. The second one is that injunction that you write these blessings, these instructions, on the doorposts of your house. That's what a mezuzah is in a Jewish home. On the right side of a doorpost in Jewish homes, the words of the Shema, this prayer, are written on a tiny scroll, and the scroll is placed in a case that is affixed to the right doorpost. And every time that a faithful person walks through those doors, in or out, you're to touch the mezuzah and kiss the fingers that touched it as an expression of love of God and a reminder of the blessing of God's commands. Shema Yisrael is not just a Sabbath-only practice, it is daily. An admonition, a reminder, put God first, integrate that priority into how you live your life every day. So once you get out of these walls and doors, what is your reminder of what is most important in your life? What do you say aloud once or twice a day? What do you bind to your head, to your hand, to your heart? What do you touch and kiss that reminds you of your first and greatest priority? Our lives swirl with competing demands. There are phone calls to make, there are texts to return or ignore. There are to-do lists, there are places to go, people to see, Facebook to post upon. But when it comes right down to it, you need to decide what is most important, who is most important, and when. It was important enough for you to show up here this morning, to be here now. in the presence of these people, in the presence of God. That's a very good practice. We learn small and big things through our worship, and those lessons don't just apply for an hour on Sunday morning. Worship is practice for life.